Now, both the image of St. Jerome and the image of the angel are Christian images. And you may be wondering to what extent these can be of significance to a Buddhist. The difficulty is more apparent than real, and is perhaps best resolved by a reference to Jung's Archetypes of the Collective Unconscious. As I think is well known, in studying the dreams of his patients, Jung discovered that these often reproduced, quite spontaneously, themes and motifs that play an important part in the various mythologies of mankind, as well as in the teachings of the different religions. Some patients, for instance, described and even painted circular figures which bore a remarkable resemblance to Buddhist mandalas. From all this, Jung eventually concluded that there were various basic psychic patterns or archetypes which were common to the whole human race, both past and present, and which found expression in myths, in religious beliefs, in dreams, and in works of art. These common psychic patterns he termed the archetypes of the collective unconscious. Though the patterns or archetypes were common to the whole human race, however, the various forms in which they expressed themselves were not. The forms were culturally determined and therefore extremely varied. Thus, although the images of St. Jerome and of the angel are Christian images, they are Christian images only in the sense that in them an archetype which is of universal significance and value has been clothed in a Christian, Italian, Renaissance form, even in a form peculiar to a particular artist. It is for this reason that it is possible for a Christian image to be of significance to a Buddhist. What the Buddhist is drawn to is not so much the Christian form of the image as the archetype of which that image is the embodiment, and it is therefore really the archetype that is of significance to him. In some cases, of course, the form taken by a Christian image, for example the crucifixion, will be so repugnant to Buddhist sentiment as to render it quite impossible for a Buddhist to be drawn to the image, and therefore, in this instance at least, to the archetype of which it is the embodiment. In other cases, such as the images of St. Jerome and of the angel, the fact that the form taken by the image is conditioned by, or belongs to, a culture with which the Western Buddhist happens to be familiar, and with which he feels a definite emotional connection, may even mean that he is drawn to it to a greater extent than he is drawn to its traditional Buddhist counterpart, where such exists, so that he is in the uncomfortable position of finding the Christian image of significance to him on account of its being the embodiment of an archetype of which he has a better intellectual understanding and a keener spiritual appreciation in specifically Buddhist terms. In yet other cases, both the Christian image and its Buddhist counterpart may be of significance to a Buddhist, and it may be clear to him that both images are embodiments within their respective cultures of one and the same archetype, even though he is at the same time fully aware that in Buddhism the archetype is incorporated within a much broader and more meaningful context. For me, this was especially so with regard to the image of the angel, which was probably one of the reasons why I was drawn to it. The image of the angel, though Christian, not only has its immediate antecedents in classical antiquity, but also its counterparts in practically all other religions and cultures, as a glance at the illustrations to Peter Lamborn Wilson's well-known book Angels will be sufficient to show. In the case of Buddhism, the principal counterparts of the image of the angel are the Deva and the Bodhisattva, as represented in traditional Buddhist art. Indeed, the Buddhist may well feel that the image of the Bodhisattva is the embodiment par excellence of the particular archetype in question. Bodhisattva is the embodiment in which the image of the angel reflects in a different cultural context and on a lower spiritual level is in fact nothing less than the archetype of enlightenment, as it may be termed, and as such immeasurably transcends the archetypes that were the subject of Jung's discoveries. This, of course, implies an enlargement of the meaning of the term archetype far beyond the significance it possesses for any current system of psychology. It also implies a stratification, so to speak, of images in accordance with the degree to which they are the embodiments of a particular archetype, and even perhaps a stratification of the archetypes themselves. This in turn implies a stratification, in the sense of an arrangement in a progressive hierarchical order, of the faculty by which the images themselves are perceived, or rather, a stratification of the successive stages of its unfoldment or manifestation. Thus one arrives at the conception of a hierarchy of levels of the imagination or imaginal faculty corresponding to a hierarchy of levels of images and archetypes or imaginal world. In Buddhism, this imaginal world is known as the world or worlds of the gods, access to the different planes and subplanes of which can be obtained through the cultivation of the corresponding mental state in the form of a particular concentration, dhyana, or sublime abode, Brahma Vihara. But, though I have spoken of the imaginal faculty, the expression should not, in a sense, be taken too literally. The imagination, or image-perceiving faculty, is not so much a faculty among faculties as the man, the spiritual man, himself. It is spoken of as a faculty because, in the case of the vast majority of people, it exists in such a rudimentary form that it appears to be simply a faculty, like, for instance, reason or emotion, or because it has not yet been developed or manifested at all. The imaginal faculty is in reality the man himself, because when one truly perceives an image, one perceives it with the whole of oneself, or with one's whole being. When one truly perceives an image, therefore, one is transported to the world to which the image belongs, and becomes, if only for the time being, an inhabitant of that world. In other words, truly to perceive an image means to become an image. So that when one speaks of the imagination, or the imaginal faculty, what one is really speaking of is image perceiving image. That is to say, in perceiving an image, what one really perceives is, in a sense, oneself.